It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin writer tells us why the Packers helped power up the workers at the Oscar Mayer plant and what might be lost now that that plant has shut down for good.
First Secretary of State Rex Tillerson announced cuts to the Special Envoy program, including getting rid of special envoys for Syria, Sudan, and the Arctic. And two legal nonprofits filed a lawsuit challenging President Trump's ban on transgender people enlisting in the military.
Outside of Washington, President Trump visited Texas yesterday as flooding from Hurricane Harvey continues to ravage that state. And here in Wisconsin, DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp announced that she's moving on to work at the EPA.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
And I want to start with President Trump's visit to Texas yesterday. Here he is in Corpus Christi, addressing a crowd gathered outside a firehouse.
Thank you, everybody. I just want to say we love you. You are special. We're here to take care. It's going well. And I want to thank you for coming out. We're going to get you back and operating immediately. Thank you, everybody. What a crowd. What a turnout. I want to thank our governor. Your governor has done a fantastic job. Governor Abbott, thank you very much. Who's right here someplace? He's right here. So we just want to thank your governor, Senator Cruz, Senator Cornyn, everybody, Dan. We want to thank the whole group. This has been a total cooperative effort. Again, we will see you soon. I will tell you, this is historic. It's epic what happened. But you know what? It happened in Texas, and Texas can handle anything. Thank you all, folks. Thank you. Thank you.
And there is the bulk of what the president said. Craig, what kind of reviews is the president getting for his visit? What are people saying?
They're definitely mixed. I mean, the chief criticism that's emerged from that visit is that the president, and not just from Democrats, but from some Republicans too, that the president kind of failed to show much empathy, that part of his job was to really kind of reach out to the victims of the flooding and express, you know, his concern for them and communicate that over and over again. The criticism is that he just kind of treated it more like almost, you know, like a typical political stop and marveling at the crowds, and that he kind of made it more about him than about what had happened.
And he didn't actually meet with any victims.
Yeah, now that may come. And again, I do think, I think some of the criticism is fair, but I also think we have to be careful about, I think we have to be cautious about kind of second-guessing and critiquing these kinds of appearances by presidents on, in disaster areas, because we've seen many presidents sort of get it from both directions. You know, if you go, you're inserting yourself for political reasons into a disaster area. If you don't go, you're being indifferent. You're showing your indifference to it. And of course, the debates over kind of when the president does go, over the Tony strikes, over where he goes. So I think this is kind of an unfolding situation. I think he's going to go back to Texas. I think the book will be. He hasn't been closed yet on kind of certainly far from closed on how he sort of handled this crisis. But I do think you saw so far, at least, you know, some kind of classic Trump stylistic touches in the way he talked about it.
And President Trump did thank the governor, say the governor had done a fantastic job, but he also said at other points that he didn't want to congratulate the effort for being, you know, perfect, getting the job done yet. He wanted to wait until the job was finished and then comment on it.
Yeah, and you have to be careful about being self-congratulatory while a crisis is still unfolding. These things are unpredictable. I mean, you know, we've seen what happened to Houston, and now we can see that Port Arthur, Texas, is having a lot of problems. We haven't seen the end of that yet. And you've got the president today talking about tax reform at the same time this crisis is still unfolding. So it's very tricky. Again, I think you have to be a little bit cautious about how you kind of unpack these, you know, these presidential visits and everything about the president's rhetoric. But I think another interesting issue, which may be more interesting than the president's handling of the crisis, is also how Congress is going to handle it. Because, you know, we've had comparisons already being made to Superstorm Sandy in the Northeast, where a lot of Republican members of Congress, including many from Texas, voted against disaster aid, and now, of course, are seeking disaster aid for their state in the middle of this crisis. So it's going to be interesting to watch that debate unfold and watch how Congress treats funding for disaster funding for Texas, and people will be comparing that very closely to Sandy.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert right now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And as you were saying, you know, the president, it seems, has taken some lessons. George W. Bush took some heat for his response to Katrina for maybe being congratulatory too early. But Ari Fleischer was the press secretary for former President George W. Bush, and he had this to say last night on Fox News.
There was something missing from what President Trump said. I hope he will say it later today. But that's the empathy for the people who suffer. That, in my opinion, should have been the first thing he should have said, was that his heart goes out to those people in Houston who are going through this, and that the government is here to help them to recover from this. And then secondly, the job of the president is to thank those who are the first responders doing all the rescuing. You know, that is a huge morale boost to those working so hard away from their families. Their homes are often flooded, but they're sacrificing themselves to save others, and the president needs to thank them. That's what a presidential visit can accomplish.
Ari Fleischer there. And Craig, you're saying we got to wait and see. What are you looking for in terms of a follow-up for President Trump?
Well, you know, you can see actually he's already on Twitter has tried to sort of, I think, deflect some of that criticism. In at least one of his tweets this morning to the people of Houston, I think an effort to kind of express that empathy that he's been criticized for not expressing on his trip. I mean, it was interesting, you know, Ari Fleischer wasn't the only Republican. He wasn't the only former Bush official who kind of offered that critique of President Trump. And again, you know, someone will be able to write a book when this is all said and done about how presidents respond to crises like this and crisis management and the political and rhetorical management of these crises, because, of course, President Bush, you know, is seen as having made a mistake in his response to Katrina that no subsequent president, you know, will want to make, which is not to respond, to under-respond, to appear to be too distant. And then so obviously we've seen President Obama handle Sandy in a different way, and now President Trump handle Harvey in a very different way. He went there. He'll probably go back there, but I think you know, people are going to be evaluating the tone and tenor of his response and his words, as they do with every aspect of his presidency for days to come.
So, Craig, moving on to other news out of Washington, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is making some pretty significant changes to the Special Envoy Program. Can you tell us what he has in mind?
Yeah, they've reduced some of the. There are special envoys of the State Department, which are kind of not part of the conventional, you know, structure of the State Department, where you have obviously you have ambassadors to all the different countries, and you have regional diplomatic positions. And these are special envoys are people that are hired kind of from the outside. Often, Russ Feingold was a special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa after he served in the Senate. Where there's a sense that there's a special problem in the world. It doesn't have to be a geographic area. It could be just an issue like AIDS, or it could be a part of the world where there's a crisis. And it's a way of focusing special attention and special effort on a special problem, international problem. There has been debate, I think, and it's not just partisan. It's on both sides of the aisle over whether there are too many special envoys. I mean, these are sort of organizational issues, but and there's merits, I believe, on both sides of the argument, but there's sort of the larger context. The reason I think it's a sensitive issue right now is because there's a broader context, which is that President Trump is proposing, you know, 30% reduction in State Department funding, including a 40% reduction in U.S. Agency for International Development, an agency, incidentally, now headed by former Wisconsin Congressman Mark Green, who I sat down with last week and talked about his taking over the reins at USAID. So there are people within the State Department and people who've been appointed by President Trump who are kind of dealing in a world of deep proposed cuts in funding. And so I think for people concerned about that, the concern about something like this is that it represents sort of a retrenchment. We'll have to see how that unfolds. I think that the whole question of funding of the State Department and funding of international aid is really in the lap of Congress now, and there's a sense that while there may be cuts, Congress, neither Republicans nor Democrats in Congress, are going to support the scale of cuts that President Trump has proposed.
We're taking a look back at the week in Washington with Craig Gilbert. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's response to Hurricane Harvey so far? What would you like to see him and the federal government do in the coming weeks and months? Are you concerned about this reduction in special envoys? Are international relations and cooperation a priority for you? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back in just a bit and take your calls. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're taking a look at the week in Washington right now with Craig Gilbert. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like President Trump has tried to reach out beyond his base, or has he hunkered down? Are you part of that base? Are you still happy with the president's performance? Do you see opportunities taken or missed? And what would it take to improve his approval rating and poll numbers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Craig, about a month ago, President Trump announced that he was banning transgender people from enlisting in the military. Seemed maybe to catch some military leaders off guard. He did make it official late last week by signing a memo to the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security. On August 9th, the president had this to say about his decision.
The transgender, the military is working on it now. They're doing the work. It's been a very difficult situation. And I think I'm doing a lot of people a favor by coming out and just saying it. As you know, it's been a very complicated issue for the military. It's been a very confusing issue for the military. And I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
And Craig, there has just this week been a lawsuit filed challenging that ban. Who's bringing the lawsuit?
The ACLU is bringing the lawsuit. I mean, it was very predictable that once the president announced this ban on Twitter, that there would be litigation over it for all the obvious reasons. I mean, what caught people off guard about it was there has been a controversy, particularly in Congress, over whether the Pentagon should fund medical bills associated with sex change treatment and therapy. Not really so much over whether transgendered people should be able to serve or should be able to continue to serve. And so President Trump went way beyond the medical issue and the insurance issue in announcing his ban. That caught the military off guard. You've not only seen litigation now on the part of the ACLU, which, again, I think we all could have foreseen, but the Pentagon has announced that it's going to study this issue, and which means that they're not going to immediately implement any kind of a ban. The transgender people in the military will continue to serve in the military while there's more analysis and more study, obviously the kind of study and analysis that hadn't been done in the run-up to the president's announcement.
In his reasoning in that initial announcement, the president said he was making this shift because of the medical costs, which you mentioned. He also said because it had become a distraction to the military.
Yeah, and again, you'd have to hear that from people in the military. From what I understand, there was not a great clamor within the brass at the Pentagon to go this far and to make this particular move. Obviously, it's a move that comes with its own disruption and cost. So you'd have to weigh that, and they would want to weigh that against whatever institutional benefits they think they're getting from taking a step like this. It's hugely controversial, and it's, you know, obviously debatable legally, and so that's ultimately, well, looking beyond whatever comes out of this further review and analysis by the Pentagon, and they're going to be doing it under the shadow of this litigation and mindful of this litigation, and then you could have the issue playing out in court as well.
And Craig, I want to turn now to a piece that you wrote looking at whether President Trump has been able to broaden his base of support since he took office. He came in with pretty low numbers, which you say gave him a lot of room to go up. Has it worked out that way?
Not really. I mean, you know, one of the most striking things about President Trump's victory, and he did win in places like Wisconsin with very high negatives. I mean, he had them throughout the campaign. The polls were right about that. I mean, on the exit poll, which is the poll of voters taken on the day of the election, I think the percentage of people in Wisconsin that had a negative view of him was something like 60%, yet he carried the state with less than 50%. But he won the election with those negatives. But at that point, it's not an issue about winning an election anymore and defeating an unpopular opponent in Hillary Clinton. It's an issue of governing. And so I think it was incumbent upon him to try to broaden his base of support. It's very difficult to govern when a large majority of people have a negative view of you, and yet we've seen him, after an initial uptick, we've seen him, his approval ratings and his favorability rating kind of drop at about 1 point a month in his first term. He's down around the mid to high 30s, so he's got the worst sort of first year ratings of any president in sort of in modern polling. But most strikingly to me was that a sense of lost opportunity, that even though he came into office with high negatives, there were clearly people that voted for him despite qualms and despite maybe their reservations about his rhetoric and his style and maybe even some of his policies, but who wanted him to succeed. I mean, after all, they voted for him. But there's not a lot of evidence in the polling that he's expanded his base of support. In fact, some groups that voted against him in Wisconsin overwhelmingly, like women and college grads and young people, are now as negative or more negative than ever toward him compared to where they were in the campaign. I mean, just to pick out one number, his positive rating among women in Wisconsin in one recent poll was in the low 20s, and his negative rating was around 70%. And that, again, that we're talking about more than half of the electorate, a demographic group without regard to party. With those kinds of numbers, it's very difficult to get anywhere near treading water in public opinion.
And how are his numbers holding with groups that help elect him, groups like men and older voters and blue-collar whites?
Well, even there, I mean, he slipped among some of those groups, not among all of them. But if you just take, for example, one group that is typically viewed as his demographic base, which is blue-collar whites, which is shorthand for whites who don't have a four-year college degree, a group that, by the way, favored him by 28 points in the election in Wisconsin over Hillary Clinton, his approval rating is something like 38%. He's in the mid to high 30s in terms of his personal popularity and his job approval rating. So he's underwater with really a group that should be favorable to him demographically. That's a problem for him. In fact, President Obama still has a positive rating from these same blue-collar whites who helped elect Donald Trump in Wisconsin, but Donald Trump has a negative rating. And Republicans, I mean, you know, a quarter to a fifth of Republicans either disapproving or having negative views, and even more having deep reservations about how he's handled the office in the same polling. Those are all pretty alarming numbers, numbers we're not used to seeing. Again, one of the points I make in the article is that we are so polarized today along party lines that each president that gets elected is more polarizing than the last, and that means that in order to succeed, the one thing you cannot afford is to have even a small minority in your own party disapprove of you, because you can pretty much count on the fact that almost every voter and almost every politician in the other party will be unfavorable, will be disapproving, will be against you. You need almost unanimous support from with your own party, and so that's why these numbers are also alarming on that score for President Trump.
And Craig, moving to our last story today, we got word yesterday that Wisconsin Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, Kathy Stepp, is leaving. She's taking a job with the EPA and has said, quote, we here in Wisconsin, that's my words, not her, we've demonstrated how we can have job creation and environmental protection. How does that square with the EPA's shaping up under the Trump presidency?
Well, you know, she's dealt with some of the same debates that the EPA under President Trump is dealing with. In fact, probably those debates are, if anything, more acute with the EPA right now, because it's being led by a very aggressive past critic of the agency, Scott Pruitt, who is seen by environmentalists and people within the EPA, meaning career people, as almost dismantling the agency. So there's a huge debate within the EPA and outside the EPA over what's happening at the EPA, which is part of obviously a more longer-running debate about strike, you know, how you strike the balance between environmental protection and economic development. But when it comes to striking that balance, obviously President Trump is in a different place than President Obama was, and probably to some degree even than President Bush was before him. So at the Wisconsin version of the EPA where Kathy Stepp was in under Governor Walker, some of these same debates unfolded. Her critics and the environmental community saw her as not being strong enough on the environment and not being strong enough on enforcement. These are the same kinds of criticisms that President Trump's EPA is fielding. So whichever side of that debate you find yourself on, it's the same debate, really.
Craig, thanks a lot. We'll catch you next time.
Anytime.
That was Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joined us to take a look at some of the biggest news stories out of Washington this week. And you can check out his article about whether President Trump's base of support, what's happening with that. You can read that on the Central Time Facebook page.
First, Nicholas Butler spent 8 months working at the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison, and he has the diaries to prove it. The Oscar Mayer plant shut down this summer after nearly 100 years. Neighborhoods had grown up around the plant, and workers traveled from down the block and from hours away to work there.
Butler calls his writings from the time the Meat Diaries, and they chronicle life inside the plant and has a relationship with the corporation that ran it. His latest book is called The Hearts of Men, a novel. Nick, good to have you back on Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, why did you start keeping diaries when you were working for Oscar Mayer after college?
Well, in truth, I started keeping diaries probably when I was a teenager, first of all, but then I think I had worked at the plant for maybe like 2 months, and there would be times when we'd be, you know, operating on the assembly line and a machine would break, and we'd be just sort of, you know, cleaning up our stations for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, a half hour, and because I was always more or less on kind of an isolated part of the assembly line, I didn't have anyone to talk to. And after a while, I just thought, well, I guess I'm going to keep a diary, and that would be something to kind of pass my time. So I think it was about 2 months into the job.
And this was something you did. You graduated college, and then it sounds like you went to study grizzly bears in Canada.
Yeah.
You come back, you get a job working in a meat processing plant. What was that like? Was it kind of a bit of a culture shock from you to go from grizzlies to being inside a factory?
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, I can remember grocery shopping with my then girlfriend, now my wife, in Madison, and just having some moments where I sort of had a nervous breakdown. You know, just like the lighting inside a supermarket would freak me out. The amount of food that was there would freak me out. And I tried to get, you know, a job that was sort of more, in line with my education and stuff, but nothing ever really happened. And I wanted to be making good money, and I wanted to have health care. And so, I got hired at Oscar Mayer, and it was weird, you know, for all the same reasons that I would have a nervous breakdown in a grocery market. But I was also very thankful to have the job, for sure.
Right, and in these diaries, I mean, you don't really disparage the work or the integrity of the work that's done there, but there were times that it was pretty tough for you and you found your own ways of coping with the difficult parts of it. Can you tell us what a daily a day was like for you at the factory?
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate. I was newly hired and I got the first shift, which started, something around 4:30, 4:45 in the morning, I think. Because I was a young guy, I had some of the more sort of physically demanding jobs on the assembly line, and we'd work until I think 12:30, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, unless there was overtime. And early on, I'm sure there's some meat packers in your audience that are listening to this and they can relate. Early on, I just couldn't get the cold and the kind of moisture of the plant out of my bones, and I was always felt sort of sick, and I got carpal tunnel syndrome from the repetitive knife work. But again, I was really fortunate to have the job. So,
I think you've got a piece, a label part of a ham and cheese loaf on one of the journals. Is that what you mostly worked on?
We did ham and cheese loaf. I think we did some kind of honey ham. We did some weird work for I think major sub sandwich restaurant chains. It was all. And enough time has passed too, where I don't remember every single lunch meat that we packed, but ham and cheese loaf was one that just sort of stuck in my head because it was not something I had ever consumed, nor have I consumed since that time.
You talk about, one of the things that it seemed like it helped get you through when you had the time was to talk to your fellow workers, the other people who lived there. What did you get in terms of a sense of the shape of their lives and what these jobs were like for them?
It was great. I have to say, I think there were some people on that I was working with that thought it was sort of strange that I had a college education and was working there. But everybody was really wonderful to me. I had the best coworkers, and it was like any other kind of blue-collar job in Wisconsin. On Monday morning, we were talking about the Packers game, and, we all were in solidarity against our sort of boss. And it's like everything else. Somebody's marriage is going through ups and downs. Somebody's kid is, a screw-up. You're complaining about the weather. It was like anything else. People were just great and hardworking and made it bearable for me.
It's interesting looking back now. Your diaries are kind of a snapshot of a disappearing time. These manufacturing jobs that you could get without a college degree, but the pay was still good and the benefits were good. And if you wanted to, you could work your whole life at that job and have a pretty decent life. And those jobs aren't so much around anymore.
No, they're not. And, I haven't lived in Madison since I was 29. I live in Eau Claire now. But when I heard about the plant closing, I really felt a sincere sadness because I knew people that had worked there, for most of their adult life. And, you didn't need a college education. I don't think you needed a high school education. And you could have good health care. You could have decent pay. And I think a lot of workers there really took pride in feeding people, in feeding the country. And when it closed, I just thought, I don't know what comes next. I don't know how we replace those jobs.
And do you worry about what the loss of a major hub like that, you lived in Madison for a while, what that does to the community around it, like your neighborhood, for instance, or a lot of Oscar Mayer people living there?
If for nothing else, it's a huge part of the east side of Madison. I don't want to romanticize the plant or the job too much because there were downsides of it, certainly. But, it was 100 years of Madison and Wisconsin history. It allowed a lot of people to spring into the middle class and then to propel their kids forward. Where are those jobs going to come from now? Who's going to move into that plant? And what about the poor folks that got laid off? So,
We're talking with Nicholas Butler right now. He's a writer living in Eau Claire, and we're talking about diaries he kept during the 8 months that he worked at the Oscar Mayer plant back in the 2000s. He calls those diaries the meat diaries. And, Nick, I know when you were there, there was some downtime. These machines were breaking down, sounds like, a lot of the time. And there was some fallow time where you were waiting for stuff to get moving again. And it sounds like you had a book club of one. You were the one guy in this book club.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Yeah, it was I called it the Oscar Mayer Book Club. And basically, I don't think anybody at corporate Oscar Mayer or Kraft really cared what I was doing on a day-to-day basis. But I thought of the diaries as a way of sort of undermining corporate power. And I also thought about the Oscar Mayer Book Club as a way of sort of undermining corporate power. So, of course, you know, I think the first selection of the Oscar Mayer Book Club was The Jungle, and then 1984. And, I read books like that anytime I could, like in the break room or if I had to go to the bathroom or if we were broke down, I would just, you know, I'd buy these cheap paperback copies and keep them in my back pocket. And I always, like, was sort of fantasized that maybe somebody from the corporate office would storm onto the production floor and demand my copy of The Jungle, but nobody really cared.
Was there a divide like that? I know there's one line I read where you talk about how you guys left covered in meat and then the people in corporate would look really nice coming in and out of the building. Was there a gap like that that you felt?
Well, I mean, of course, there's a lot of, I mean, the people that were working in the, you know, on the corporate part of the plant, I'm all great people and stuff like that. But, you know, we would wear like a cotton smock and then a paper smock. So we weren't like leaving the plant like literally covered in lunch meat, but you smelled like lunch meat. And like the bottom of my jeans would be wet with sort of like gross lunch meat juice and stuff. And I think after just a hard day of that kind of work, walking out into the plant and then looking at somebody leaving the exact same sort of facility in a suit and tie was a little bit like boarding an airplane and walking past first class and just sort of, you know, giving those folks a look. so.
And Nick, this is a job that I think a lot of us have had jobs along the way where we're trying to figure what we want to do, figure ourselves out, or we just, maybe we can't get anything else at the time, and we end up in some surprising jobs. And this was one of those for you. Do you regret anything about it? Are you glad it's part of the Nicholas Butler history?
I certainly don't regret anything about it at all. And I think what those jobs that you're describing, this job in my life, for me, it's a reminder of where I am now and how much I like my life now, and how I think sometimes, you know, for me, that wasn't the right job. That doesn't mean that for other people it's not. But for me, I had to have a series of sort of strange and different jobs until I finally found, you know, what I wanted to do most in the world. And so now I look back at that and think, oh, okay, like, I feel very fortunate that I'm at the place that I'm in now.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was Eau Claire writer Nicholas Butler joining us to talk about the meat diaries. Those are his memories of working at the Oscar Mayer plant back in the 2000s. His newest novel is called The Hearts of Men.
And we want to hear from you now on a related topic. Did you ever have a job like that that surprised you? That was something you hadn't planned on doing, but you ended up out of necessity, out of curiosity. Did you get something out of it? Was it an important part of your development as a person? Did you stay with it on purpose, or you just got to stayed there out of inertia? Call in now at 800-642-1234. And do you think we lose something if we just go right into a career and stick with it and stay on that path forever? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And coming up, we'll talk to two state lawmakers about a bipartisan effort to close the so-called dark state loophole in Wisconsin.
Right now, you can call in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had a job that surprised you, like Nicholas Butler, our last guest, did? Something you maybe stumbled into by accident or out of necessity? Did you stick with it and discover that you loved it? like it or not, was it an important part of who you are now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our first caller now. We've got Liz joining us in Madison. Liz, hi.
Hi, Veronica. I'm calling in with just a short story of being in a state of life transition in my 30s. I had previously been a teacher, but now because I was going through a divorce, I found myself working kind of the night shift as a grocery cashier. It was a very humbling experience for me. And the thing that really stuck with me was that all of my coworkers were teenagers from the local area, and they would come to me for advice and encouragement. And it was because of that that I went back and got my master's degree, and now I'm a school counselor.
Oh, wow. So you learned your way, and you started, did it on the job there and realized that was what you wanted to do with the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, by no stretch of the imagination did I think that I was supposed to be there at that grocery store, you know, checking out groceries. But because of that, it helped me figure out what I did want to do with my life.
What a great story. Thank you so much, Liz. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for that, Liz. We talked to our coworkers around WPR. We heard from Mike in IT. He had operated one of the first returnable bottle vending machines, or, you know, you return a bottle, you put them in, and you get a refund. He was the guy who sorted all those out. So this is high-tech equipment in the 1970s, but then there's just a person behind it, kind of a Wizard of Oz scenario, I guess, sorting all the stuff out as it comes in.
And let's go to another caller now. We've got Stephanie joining us in Two Rivers. Stephanie, hello.
Hi. So my interesting thing is I went to graduate school for graphic design and always thought I would work at an agency, but then I talked to Jim Moran, who's the director at the Hamilton Wood Type and Printing Museum in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, and now I'm the assistant director.
Oh, wow. So a conversation rerouted you there.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing because all of my past experiences being like a photographer's assistant and a graphic designer have come together, and really I feel like I'm at home.
Wow. Stephanie, thanks for that.
Yeah, everybody, I got to say, Stephanie, everyone in my family has been to Hamilton except for me. My brother has given a talk there, my wife and kids, my parents. I still have to get up there. So I'm looking forward, Stephanie, to a visit, and congratulations on ending up there.
And now you know Stephanie's life story, too.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. All right, thanks a lot, Stephanie. And here's one from Keely. This is one of Joy Cardine's producers. She describes herself as a nerd. She wound up unexpectedly at the front desk at a Harley-Davidson dealership in South Dakota. She said, my loved ones were leery, but the place was far from a dingy chop shop. It had shiny chrome, meticulous lighting, and a cappuccino machine. She said she answered phones 5 feet from a bike worth more than $35,000, chatted with bikers with tattoo sleeves who rode to benefit sick kids, welcomed business owners and surgeons, she says, decked out in their leathers, and got to know a woman who matched her manicure to her Harley hog. True story.
Great story. Now you can share your stories, the job you didn't expect to end up at, and what you learned there. 800-642-1234 is the number. 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Menominee. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your job you wanted to tell us about?
So my first job was actually at the Oshkosh Culver's, and I started out just bussing tables and helping out guests, and I enjoyed it a lot. So when I went to UW-Stout, I transferred and started working with Gary Tilke at the Menominee Culver's there. And when I finished up with schooling, I really loved the philosophy that Gary had and the importance of taking care of people and serving the guests. So I just ended up saying, you know what, this is what I really want to do, and I dove into it with him, worked my way up to a general manager, just completed my franchisee class down in Sauk City with Culver's, and was approved to buy in with him. And I think the biggest thing that I learned is just people are everything. It doesn't matter what you do for a job, it's the people around you and the people that you serve and the care that you give them that really makes, for me, the day enjoyable.
So. Well, Michael, I want to add, that's really interesting because that you did the food service job that I think a lot of people do as their first jobs. You didn't stop there. This is your career. You're about to be a Culver's franchise owner after all those years.
Yeah, I'm actually just graduated last month and working on the paperwork right now with, you know, getting everything situated. And it's really exciting. It's a great opportunity. It's a wonderful franchise. they really preach it's all about the people. And when you dive into that philosophy, it's just, it makes going to work so enjoyable.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing that story. Appreciate it. At 800-642-1234.
And we're going to go next now to Holly in Fort Atkinson. Holly, hi.
Hi.
What is your story?
Well, I went to school for nursing. I nursed for a while. Then I had children, and when it was time to go back, I decided to go into social work and got a couple more degrees. And while I put my resume out everywhere, and I didn't remember all of them, and I was called by the department for a job as a forensic specialist, working with people who have committed crimes but been found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. And I never, ever thought I would do that, and I didn't even think I would stick with it. I thought, well, for a job, just to get back into work. But I've been at it now over 11 years.
Wow.
And I might be retiring from it. I don't know.
Wow. Wow, that's so interesting, Holly. Thank you so much for that call. It makes me think about how a lot of times it's these twisty turns that define kind of who we are, first of all, but also where we end up.
That reminds me, there was this person who worked here at WPR for a long time ago, and somebody who was in charge of the weekend board ops said something like, your voice is okay, you want to be on the air? And that person's name was Veronica Rickert.
Well,
Randall Davidson, talking to you.
Yeah, he said, you don't have anything too wrong with your voice. Do you want to be on the radio? So yeah, that's me too, Holly.
Yeah, and I kind of stumbled backwards into radio too, and I like it okay still. I'm down with it.
All right, good to hear.
Back to your calls. Leonard is with us in Racine. Leonard, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What's your story, Leonard?
So when I was younger, I started off in, working in the restaurant businesses, and I recall filling out an application for a job that I thought never in the world that I would get, and it was more of like volunteering. But I ended up getting a job working for Family Services of Racine as a parent teacher, and I was only 25 years old myself, so it was kind of interesting to get that job teaching parents that were older than me how to be parents.
Huh.
But it was a really great job. So, I ended up with a salary doing it and got sponsored through Children's Services Society as another person to pay me. So it was a great job that I ended up with, and it actually got me to go to school to become a preschool teacher after that.
Wow. Great story, Leonard. Thank you so much for sharing that. Wow. Just so many people who ended up in a career path.
Yeah, I know.
That they hadn't planned. Maybe there should be like a requirement that you try like 10 different jobs
or
something.
Well, actually, right. That's something that Nicholas Butler has said in different places about, not necessarily on this show today, but that, that those meandering paths can really do us a favor because we get to learn about ourselves in the process. So thanks a lot, Leonard. Thanks for sharing that. Let's go now to Benjamin in Chippewa Falls. Benjamin, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for talking to me. My unexpected job was I was laid off. I was offered a job when I worked in Chicago at the Chicago Board of Trade. This would have been in 2005. And I was the guy who took the call from Lehman Brothers on September 15th to sell all their treasury note positions.
Wow.
I had no education in this whatsoever. And people spoke a totally different language when I began doing it, but I started to love it. I was eventually laid off, but the time there helped me to learn how to be cool under pressure, and that was what directly led me to be able to work at an emergency room, at a level one trauma emergency room.
Wow.
In Chicago for 2 years. And it really did teach me how to just stay calm and how
Wow.
to stay focused. And I had no idea I would ever be able to do something like that, but I got to learn economics from the front row seat. So the day the Dow market dropped 777 points,
yeah,
I got to be there and watch.
That's incredible. Yeah, Benjamin, thank you for sharing that. Wow, what a story. And you can see how there would be cross-pollination between those two jobs.
Definitely. So many good stories. More callers that I'm afraid we don't have time for. You can keep sharing stories like this over on the Central Time Facebook page. And we ought to do this again sometime, I think. Obviously, a lot of great stories. But again, tell us the job you didn't expect to end up in that changed your life for better or for worse. Do that over on the Central Time Facebook page. The movie It will be in theaters this week. The movie, based on Stephen King's novel, features an evil supernatural force that takes the form of a lot of things, including a clown.
It looks like a very scary movie, although almost anything looks scary to me. But one group of people is more scared than the most actual clowns.
In an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, the president of the World Clown Association says the movie is bad for the clown business, with people canceling clown appearances at parties and school events.
And more generally, the group is worried about the association of clowns with fear, from various versions of It to a nationwide scare last year about evil clowns supposedly walking the streets of regular towns.
The group has put out a press kit on the evil clown phenomenon, including the statement that, quote, the art of clown is something to be treasured and enjoyed. I feel for the clowns here.
I feel for the clowns too. And sometimes, you know, there is a fine line. I've really enjoyed some of the clowns that I've seen at Circus World actually recently. Other times, I'm not so sure.
Well, okay. So I think we need to kind of rehabilitate the clown image. Watch it. Realize it's fiction.
Or don't watch it.
Maybe that'll help even more. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.